So my name is Winnie. I'm a priest from New York, from Trinity Church on Wall Street, and I bring you greetings from all of us, and I'm really glad to be here, and thanks to you all for having me. There's a man at Trinity who we don't actually know his diagnosis, but I suspect he would have a proper diagnosis if he were to have been born later. He doesn't communicate a lot, and he has this really amazing skill for all of us of the way he communicates with us. Instead of saying hi, hello, he'll turn his head to the side after looking at you with a little gleam in his eye and kind of say or do or sing the thing you're most known for. So he comes up to our deacons and will start to sing the Exalted in exactly the way that deacon sings the Exalted, the right pitch, right? Whenever he sees me, he always looks at me and then looks down and says, please be seated. So you've heard the good part. You can relax now. Apparently that's the most important thing I do. So at Trinity, the other thing I'm known for is if something really tough happens in the world, if we have one of those weeks where our faith in ourselves and who we are as people is shaken, or the readings are just really hard, almost always, not always, but almost always, I'm up that Sunday. So I'm really relieved to get some nice readings. These are some good ones. These are about love. So we know that God is love. John is all about love, and that the Word from the beginning is a part of creation, which is love. Love like a father for a child, right? From the beginning. So simple, really. Really happy that that's what we're talking about today. And the Acts reading, Paul in Athens, is iconic for me. I was a chaplain at Columbia for 7 years. And the chapel at Columbia has in the window behind the altar, so up there, one image, and it's that story of Paul at the altar to the unknown God. And you know, we stop the reading where we stop it because it doesn't work out so well for Paul at the end of that. It's not like all the Athenians say yes and become followers of Jesus. And so as a chaplain at Columbia, it was sort of mortifying. Week after week, you'd go up and you're like, even Paul couldn't convince people that there was this other unknown God. How am I going to do that? That there's something here greater than us, more powerful than us, maybe in a way we don't understand, that explains the great dissonances of life. Because in the end, wouldn't that be the reason to have yet one more shrine or altar? That we've got a God to everything the people in Athens had, everything. And yet, we still cannot understand how it is that life works the way it works. Because if we can understand that, we don't need gods. But they couldn't. And they had so many of them. They had really good ones. They had very reasonable ones. They had some really creative ones. They had quirky ones. They kind of covered the whole landscape of the kind of characters you could have and the kind of power that you'd want your gods to have. And yet, there's this other one. So Paul says there's this man, Jesus, who in his life shows you and will show you, if you follow, what is missing. We clearly believe that, or you wouldn't be here. And we get these readings, and we know them well, these really wonderful ones that are fairly neutral, that say in the end, it is about this profound love, as though we are one with Jesus, one with God. That's just good, right? And yet, even for us, I would say, knowing the nature of God as it is taught to us, knowing these texts coming to this table, don't you wonder why life works out the way it works out? If you don't at all wonder, God bless you. My best line is, please be seated. But I wonder, don't you wonder? How can it be? If you don't experience injustice around you, God bless you, but I might encourage you to open your eyes wider. It's everywhere, isn't it? And we can start from the really fundamental things that are all of our personal lives. Why does our health work out the way it does? Why do the people we love or that we care about or that we note around us that suffer in the ways that they do? And at our worst, we might try to tighten that up and say, well, there was that time, you know, really, he's a jerk, and you can kind of see how that might come back, you know, karma or something like that. But at our best, and for those we love the most sincerely, we know that's not true. There is no great balance to this universe that makes it all make sense. So what is this God of love? Who is this God of love? That Paul says is the answer to that question today. One of the challenges of being a Christian person is we are actually not taught that if we tighten everything up and do everything right, that we are saved. Now, for someone like me, that's a relief because it's not one of my strengths, right? I'm not a very rigid person. I don't tend to follow the rules. If you give me a rule, my first inclination is to consider all the really funny ways it could be broken. And some of us have personalities like that, so thank God, right, that it's not the straight and narrow is the only way. But the thing about it for Christians is it's really not the way. We are told that love is the way, that following Jesus is the way, and the way of Jesus is love. And the way he talks about love and acts love is to go to the places and the people that we would find the least likely not just to deserve love, but to want our love. Isn't that what happens to him? We don't know that Samaritans are necessarily poor. We don't know that many of the people that he goes out beyond the margins to are in need in any way necessarily. What we know is these are communities that don't need each other, don't want each other, don't like each other, and at times absolutely marginalized and disenfranchised as well. But places where love might not be the way that you reach out, and frankly, your love might even be wrong. What do you really know about those folks? How do you really love someone you don't know at all? The text says we only know God in love. And so if we seek to be out in the world in love, or out in the world on behalf of God, right, with this good news, we have to go out in that way. So here's the homework assignment. It's the end of the school term. If you are a student or if you're a teacher, you know that this is the time of the year that if you get an assignment, you might not have to do it and no one might notice. So I'm not coming back. I won't know if you do it. But I'd like you to think about it. This is like one of those summer assignments where it's really more for you than for the product at the end. So if any of you have ever encountered IKEA or anything like it where you have to assemble things and there are directions and there's kind of a graphic that takes you there, I want you to think that way about something graphic like that. And what I'd like you to do, and even if you just do it while you're sitting here and thinking about it and wishing I would stop, I want you to think about the landscape of love in your life. The whole trajectory of your life, from the beginning, as far as you can remember, to right now, where has it come from? Where is it? Where have you offered it? What is your experience of that? And up to you. I'm not going to tell you what love is or which love matters. But what is it for you? Because the truth is, a lot of how you understand what God is in the world is connected to that. So for me, and I feel lucky in this, I had, of my two grandmothers, one of them just nailed the love part. And a lot of us have grandmothers like that, but wow, did she just get that right. And I just thought that's what grandmothers did. I never thought very critically about the fact that my other one wasn't quite like that. She was a little bit more stern, a little bit more like a parent, frankly. Good person. But I had one who just made you feel like she was your favorite. And she did it so well that the way I would tell the story of my life with my grandmother and the times I got to see her in India, until she died, I would have said I was her favorite. There are 15 of us grandchildren, I think, maybe more. I'm thinking of about 15 right now. Maybe a couple more. She had seven children. There are lots of us. Yeah, I'm getting this all wrong. Maybe there are 20 of us. I don't know. There's a lot of us. When she was dying, a lot of us got to go back, and it was a good death. She was 100 years old. And all the cousins were sitting around in the front. I'm one of the older cousins. I'm in my 40s. The youngest cousins were in their 20s, most of them in their 30s. Some of their little kids were around. And all of our parents that could gather, the children and the husbands, the partners, were in the other room.
And they were having kind of a tense conversation, the kind you probably had or get around when someone's dying. It's difficult. Wasn't completely clear to me what all the tension was about, but there was some tension. So we were in the other room because it was so awkward. Witness our parents struggling in that way, and their mother was dying. How painful was that for us? I had never thought about my mother in that way. Sad for us. So as we sat there kind of quietly, not sure what to do or say, every once in a while someone would tell a story that kind of made it clear that this was one of those, yeah, she loved me the best, it's hard to tell this story, but it's going to make you guys feel bad, but I want to tell it. And it took us a couple of these for a couple of us to look around. All of us think that about her, don't we? We sort of said it, didn't really say it, but hinted at it. And it's not because she said, I love you the best. It's just something about how she treated us that made all of us, every one of us, convinced that we would favor her. I hope I'm that to this realization, which is painful for all of her egotistical grandchildren sitting around, that we were not her favorite, necessarily. Is that better?
That's better. Yeah, I can see that. So you probably heard the really bad news that I'm not my grandmother's favorite. So as my cousins and I are sitting there, realizing that we are all not her favorite, and realizing also what petty and horrible people we are that we're thinking about that while she's dying in the other room, and her children are sitting barely able to bear their grief in the other room, this man comes into her house that I don't recognize, just walks in the front door. We're sitting in the front room, the door's open. And he starts going around the house, and I think I don't recognize him. But I don't come to India that often, so maybe he's a close friend or a neighbor. He's in bad shape. His clothes are kind of a mess. And he's wailing, kind of shouting and loud, and we're a really quiet family. And he goes running around the house, and we are all so shocked at what's happening to my grandmother that none of us do anything about it. And you can tell at some point he finds her room, and we don't do anything about that either. And he wails and tries to wake her up. And she's not dead, but she hasn't spoken to anyone for about a day at that point. And then he starts running around this house, wailing and crying about Ammachi, which means mother. And it was almost as though, like, we had rented a dervish of our own to express all of our feelings, because it's the kind of thing my family would do. Like, there are our feelings. There they go all over the house. And at some point, someone does realize we should do something about this. None of us recognize him. No one has figured this out. Someone goes and talks him down a little bit and walks him out and takes him to the back. And we ask who that was. And my aunt, who lived in that house, the wife of my mother's youngest brother, says, that's someone that's the son of a neighbor. He's grown up in this neighborhood. He's probably your age, Winnie. He's in his 40s. Your grandmother has known him his entire life, and he's had a tough life. You can see he's not sober. He's addicted. When he is in really bad shape and should not go home, he comes here. And your grandmother, when she was younger, would clean him up and make some food and sit with him and wash his clothes and hang them in the back and wait with him until he was in better shape and then send him home or out into the world again. And so when she became not able to do that, my aunt said, I had to do it. And I didn't want to do it at first, but I did it. Because she would say, feed him, help him, he needs help. Now, in case you are in any way under the illusion that we're a generous and open and welcoming family, we're not. You know, my family is judging and rigid, and there were very high expectations all the way through our lives of what we would do with them. We're not the kind of family to even tolerate a lot of noise inside the house. So who was this woman, my grandmother, who, as of 5 minutes ago, had loved me the best and now was somehow seeing the dignity and worth and not judging this guy who ranged around in her house like a crazy person and in the neighborhood like a nut and knew not to go to his own house? He was such a mess. Who was she? And maybe he thought she loved him the best as well. And maybe that's why it was safe to go into that house. So my grandmother clearly is not God, and she had plenty of flaws. I'm sure I'm not aware of what they were, except that she left us, but I'm sure she had some. But I think this God that loves us, that we talk about, as we are, this God that is love, this God whose landscape of love in your life I've asked you to map out in some way so that you can see it, and see it and think about it before, like me, you're watching the end of someone's life who has been all love to you and don't have time for the important questions. Map it out now. And map it out because there are places in your own life where it is broken and it has been compromised and it's not right. Because that, too, has probably influenced your understanding of who God is. Look at it so that you know if in this community you need some help with that, because that's what this community is for. And maybe there are places where love has been shown to you, where you understand it, or where you have been taught about it because it has been shown to someone else, that is radical and beautiful and unexpected. And I'll tell you, it forms how you understand who God is in the world, what this thing is within which we move and live and have our being. And you want to know what that is. And the reason you want to know what that is we are told that we are called to go out and proclaim it, to follow Jesus, to go and do it. Now, as good news and happy as all these readings are, that's a tough one. I don't know what it was in my grandmother that caused her to see that man clearly and to love him enough to help him to return to his own dignity in her own very small way. But if I'm honest, I don't necessarily know what it was that caused her to see anything in me either. I'm nothing like her, nothing. And if she chose to love, as we all do, regardless of relationship, not because we must, the truth is we choose it, and people choose us. And we are told that that is the nature of who God is. So if God is acting in this world in love, to some degree, God is a little bound by our capacity to act in this world in love. Not totally bound. God can choose someone else. We know that. But you have a responsibility as a child of God to act in this world in love. We live and move and have our being in the life of this God who reaches out to us in love. And what Jesus shows us is the way to go and find that and expand it and to become more than you could ever imagine, to understand that God who makes not yet enough sense to us, the great mystery, is to go to those places where you cannot imagine your love is needed, or where any love will be, or that you could make a difference or be seen, or where you are sure so much love is needed, but how could it just be you that could go out and make any difference in that? We are told that when we walk out in love, it is not just ourselves that we proclaim. It's not up to us. And we might feel ourselves to be as unsuccessful as Paul, going out and proclaiming as well as we can. And often for us, proclaiming means showing up and being ourselves as well as we can. And it might feel inadequate, but you can probably see in your own community how, as we have stepped out in love in every generation in the church, we find ourselves to be diverse and inclusive and powerful and loving in ways we could not have imagined a decade before. And it's easy. It becomes part of who we are. So I can't, I'll be honest. I do wish I had a better line than please be seated. And I do wish I had a better heart than to wish that I was still my grandmother's favorite. And I am grateful that in the end, on that day when all of us were a little crushed and a little laughing at ourselves and a little embarrassed and a little feeling inadequate to hold the people who had loved us so well, well enough to hold their grief, that we got this glimpse of love so much more profound than we knew could exist in our family. What a gift. And what we know in the readings today is this God in whom we live and move and have our being waits for us with that kind of love and knows of us that we can bear it out into the world in the name of God. Amen.